The jihadists lost their revolutionary battle against the state, which proved too strong for them. The state deployed effective security services and enjoyed international support. It knew how to divide the opposition, and it doled out small concessions in the area of political reform to siphon off popular anger. In Egypt, the insurgency was decisively crushed. In Algeria, the GIA continues to kill, but with no prospect of victory. In Saudi Arabia, the burgeoning Islamist opposition was humbled in the mid-1990s. In Pakistan, the religious parties were Talibanized, but when the military regime decided to abandon the Taliban, the religious radicals were not able to derail the change in policy. Among Shiites, revolutionary fervor has died in Iran and holds little appeal elsewhere. These governments may not have an indefinite lease on life, but for the foreseeable future, they have a strategy that will keep them in power. Does this mean that jihadist Islam has no future in the lands from which it emerged? Can the jihadists inspire a mass movement? Al-Qaeda's consistent clarity about the restoration of the realm of Islam indicates that the jihadists have not abandoned their goals, despite the defeats they have suffered at the hands of the state over the past decade. The jihadists believe that victory over both the far and the near enemies is not only possible, but inevitable. That is why they continue to invest so much into the many fields of jihad, as Sheikh Rahman has called them, countries where the militants are determined to continue their struggles to defeat the apostates and create an Islamically pure society. Their conviction that they may yet vanquish the near enemies is not entirely delusional. Within Arab Muslim countries, especially those that are vital to regional stability and U.S. interests, the radicals may have lost the war against the state, but they have won the theological debate. In the Middle East and Pakistan, religious discourse dominates societies, the airwaves, and thinking about the world. Radical mosques have proliferated throughout Egypt. Bookstores are dominated by works with religious themes. In Saudi Arabia, nearly one in five undergraduates majors in Islamic studies. In Jordan, a Salafia form of Islam is surging via informal social networks, eclipsing tamer forms of Islamism. In Pakistan, religious education is supplanting public education and creating a generation of zealots. The demand for Sharia law, the belief that their governments are unfaithful to Islam and that Islam is the answer to all problems, and the certainty that the West has declared war on Islam, these are the themes that dominate public discussion. Islamists may not control parliaments or government palaces, but they have occupied the popular imagination. Strengthening the appeal of radical Islam is the illegitimacy of the governments that oppose it. Egypt is more authoritarian now than it was a decade ago. Saudi Arabia is casting about for ways to appear more legitimate without actually expanding political participation. Jordan has delayed parliamentary elections and passed newly repressive laws. Algeria is run behind the scenes by its army, and Pakistan has a military dictator. The political oppression that invited a violent reaction in the 1990s has, in some cases, grown worse. In only a handful of countries, mostly small Persian Gulf states, has there been liberalization. The governments, of course, understand that some form of popular legitimacy is essential to their survival. They also know that the wind is blowing toward Islam. So their quest has led them to burnish their own Islamic credentials. Even Nasser appreciated this need. Sadat understood it better still. He went to mosque, adopted traditional dress, changed the Egyptian constitution to make Sharia a source for Egyptian law, and gave free rein to the Islamist groups that ultimately gunned him down. Even as it throws Muslim brothers in jail, Mubarak's regime is fighting for control of religious discourse by strengthening its grip on the clerics of Al-Azhar, licensing and staffing the mosques, and acquiescing to court challenges of family laws that offend the Islamists. In Saudi Arabia, the king's right to rule is explicitly based on religious credentials. The regime imprisons Islamists who question whether he is fulfilling his Islamic responsibilities, but it also appropriates their language of piety and gives scope to their anti-Western rhetoric. As in Egypt, this deflects popular resentment from the regime and turns it onto the United States. The secular British-educated general who runs Pakistan uses Islamic language to buttress his credibility in an increasingly strident religious environment. But this strategy of competing with the opposition on its issues cannot be sustained indefinitely. Every flanking movement undertaken by these regimes validates the Islamist agenda. The state's claims to superior religious authority are not taken seriously, and the official clergy are regarded as regime parrots. The game is now played by Ibn Taymiyyah rules. Apostate governments are illegitimate, and so are the ulema that defend them. In the race to show the people who is more Islamic, the Islamists will win every time. Sooner or later, the regimes will discover that challenging the Islamists at their own game endangers their long-term survival.